on 94.7 WPBC LP Charlottesville with your hosts Clinton Johnston and Leslie M. Scott Jones, Charlottesville's only radio show devoted to local arts. And now, here's...
Nothing's... Oh, good morning, Sunday morning. Whether you're an art maker, an art breaker, an art faker, or an art partaker, welcome all, because of course all are welcome to Homegrown, your show about local art, brought to you by the Blue Moon Diner. I'm here, I'm the one they call Clinton, and I'm here with the person who is so fantabulous that I believe Charlottesville is thinking about making her the subject of their very next festival. Hello, Leslie M. Scott Jones.
Good morning, Clinton. I would love a festival named after me. That would be amazing.
You might love a festival. I don't know if you want a Charlottesville festival named after you, because Charlottesville festivals are so poorly, poorly named.
Oh, really?
And I think that's the thing that they're waiting for right now in terms of your festival. They're going over, here are the choices, I think, so far.
Okay.
The Les Festival, which there are concerns. There are concerns. Either that or Jonesen. Both of those... Problems.
Yes. Yeah, it's both of those are problems. We could just call it the Goddess Festival.
You could call it the Goddess Festival.
I mean, because let's face it, that's what I am.
So great to have you back.
You missed me last week, didn't you?
Indeed.
I know. I missed you too.
You know what we didn't miss?
What?
Our parental advisory.
Oh, yes, let's do that.
We did that. Our parental advisory. We are going to send out a parental advisory to all you parentals out there. At one point in our show, we'll try not to, of course, but we may just have technical difficulties, which, you know, that never happens on our show.
No.
But we may just say the word Widdershins. Widdershins.
What?
If you have tender little ones out there, or even slightly dense big ones, because the slightly dense big ones need love too. I'm on your side. Then you might hide them to keep them from hearing us use the word Widdershins. All right. Let's take it to our first guest. Joining us for our first time here on Homegrown, local photographer Will Kerner.
Hi, Clinton.
How you doing, Will?
I'm well.
Let's try that again. How you doing, Will?
I'm well, Clinton. How are you? I'm still well, and I'm still Will.
Excellent.
I'm sorry. That was my fault. I was trying to fix something else over here, technical, and forgot to turn your mic on.
Do we get to say everything twice today?
Indeed. Indeed. We do.
Excellent.
So, Will, welcome to Homegrown. How you doing?
Doing well.
Yes. It's all gone Widdershins all so quickly. Are you film festivaled out?
Not quite. I'm actually going to go to two more films today. There's a new film by Pedro Almodovar, the Spanish director, at Culbreth at noon called Julieta that I'm going to go to. And then there's a film made in the deserts of southern Israel called Sandstorm with some Bedouin actors that I'm going to go to this evening. So
there are Bedouin actors?
Well, yes, a few.
Wow.
A few. Enough to make a film, apparently.
I guess so. I wonder what the cattle call is like for Bedouin actors. How far do they have to travel to go to those auditions?
Actually, there are Tibetan actors, too. And about 20 years ago, speaking of the film festival, I went with local filmmaker Paul Wagner.
And
worked on a film called Wind Horse,
which was
made in the Himalayas. It was basically done in Nepal with a little bit of shooting in Tibet. And in that case, he brought a couple of actors from the U.S. and largely auditioned local people and worked with non-English speaking, just native Tibetans, and made a beautiful film with these people that was really realistic. And the reason he chose to do that was that they had an empathy for the subject that he felt would come through on the screen, which it did, which he couldn't get if he sort of tried to bring in an actor from the outside. So because it's film and you can do short clips, you know, short takes and retakes as many as you need, he was able to pull it off. But we digress. From whatever we're doing.
Although, you did do me a setup for a segue.
Okay.
Which is saying, clearly, you are no stranger to traveling.
That's true. I have traveled quite a bit in my life. I have traveled and photographed and worked on projects in Southeast Asia, in Africa, in South America, the Caribbean, in a range of places.
Cool. And travel and photography has borne fruit for your latest exhibit up right now, McGuffey.
My latest exhibit is a show called Far Away, So Close, and it's photographs from Iceland, Haiti, and India at the McGuffey Art Center until November 20th, 2 weeks from today. It comes down.
Neat. So why those three places? Are those the places you had? Is there a stylistic or thematic link through them?
That's a good question, which several people have asked. Iceland, Haiti, India, that's the far corners of the earth. What's the relation? The fact is, that's the three major trips that I've been on in the past year and a half, and so that's where I had work from. When I go to a country, I don't always or actually seldom have a pre-planned project that has a specific theme or a specific idea. It's more that I go to the environment, I've learned something about the country, and I open myself up to what I discover when I go there. It's kind of like, I would say, letting the pictures come to me versus me going in with a preconception and trying to make specific pictures on a specific subject. So then after I've shot all this work, I come back and edit, and then I may see a through line and themes as I see in this show. So, for example, the bulk of the work is from Haiti and India. And in that work, I see a lot of images. There's a number of portraits, just candid portraits, not staged portraits. And there's a number of doorways, transitions, spaces where you transition from one space to another as you are viewing the photograph. So you could be standing inside of a temple complex and you see this doorway, and on past that doorway you see some prayer flags or mountains, or you could be looking into an ancient temple with a person sitting in an archway. There's a lot of sort of transitions and kind of became the theme that emerged, I guess you could say, after the fact, after I'd shot it, when I was editing.
Right. That's interesting, because that seems to be a work process that I hear applied to filmmaking most commonly. People would say, well, we get the shots that we get, but really the creation of the work happens when you go back and you're in the editing booth and you look at it. Are you shooting digitally or shooting on film?
I'm shooting digitally.
So yeah. I'm wondering if shooting digitally has changed the way you work or has facilitated that approach, because you're not sitting there worried about burning film with each shot.
That's an excellent question, and I'd say the answer is yes, it has. I've been using digital for about 10 years, and prior to that, I shot with film exclusively. And when, in the era of film, you really made a lot of decisions, editorial decisions, if you will, as you were shooting. You didn't just sort of shoot tons of frames and then go home and figure out what you had, because the cost of film. Digital turned that completely around. With digital, you can shoot a lot, and then you go home and sort of make those kind of editorial decisions later in the editing room, as it were. Now, I would say that my own style of working really sort of straddles the two. Just because I'm using a digital camera doesn't mean I go to a situation and bang, 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 shoot 100 frames. I'm still working because that's the way I worked for so many years, with the kind of looking and waiting, you know, moving myself around in relation to the subject and waiting for the appropriate moment to come up. And then when that happens, sometimes I do shoot only one frame. Oftentimes, if I'm working on a subject, I might shoot more like 5 or 10 frames. But it's not this kind of barrage of frames where you've got like 100 frames that all occurred within a couple of minutes and then you're, you know, like that. So because to me, part of the original creative act in photography is what's called the decisive moment, which Cartier-Bresson coined that phrase maybe almost a century ago. And someone asked Cartier-Bresson, where is the creativity in photography? Why is it an art? And he said, it occurs in 1/125 of a second, referring to the shutter speed. So what he meant was, you know, when you shoot, when you use your eye and you use your finger and you fire at that exact instant, that's the sort of creative decisive act. And I think that if you just take a camera and use it like a machine gun, I don't know, that would take a lot of the art out of it for me.
Yeah, it's interesting, because there's so many times when I look at a photograph, and I know when other people look at photographs, and there's that image, and you think, wow, how did that person get that image? You can feel the tension, you can feel the action, you can feel that there is an event that's right on the cusp of about to be done and about to have been the past, that somehow somebody is caught right at that moment. And I think, is that what you're talking about?
That's
in terms
the
of that?
Skill of a great, I mean, there are all kinds of photographers and all kinds of photographic work. So, for example, in my work, most often there are human beings in the frame. And so deciding when to exactly press the shutter button, when those, when that individual or individuals, how they are in relation to the rest of the whole composition, that's sort of the decisive moment, as it were. But I've also actually, especially in recent years, begun shooting more still life. So in my current show, I'd say maybe a quarter, something like that, a quarter or a third of the frames have, of the images, have no people in them. So okay. I think, you know, right. that's right. something where the decisive moment doesn't quite fit in. There, yeah. it's more about yeah. composition. It's about the light.
Yeah, can we talk about still lives? Because
sure,
I will admit that I have noticed over the past couple of years of really looking at photography more than I had previous, that I am very drawn to pictures of other people, to pictures of people.
Yes.
Right. And so what's the appeal of the still life of?
For me, I think part of the appeal of the still life is you are, the viewer has the opportunity to look at an image and make their own interpretation of what they see or have their own reaction to it. It's kind of a, I think, generally more of a contemplative type experience, I would say. Of course, there's all ranges of experience, but in general terms, a still life is an opportunity to sort of have a quiet moment with an image and just think about and absorb what the photographer was seeing, what they're trying to transmit to you, what's interesting about this particular scene. And there's a certain tension that's removed because there are no human beings in it. It's just, as it says, still life. So it's just inanimate objects in a frame. So it's a kind of a different experience. Once you have humans in the frame, naturally, because we are humans, we will start reacting to that and thinking about what that person is doing or so forth and go into that whole narrative. So,
right. There's a persona upon which we can either place ourselves or that, I think narrative is a good term. Like we start, I know that I certainly start creating narratives.
And we identify, we either identify or don't identify, but we have some relationship with this other human being or beings that we see in that picture.
Yeah. Cool. So, thinking about what you were saying with a theme developing with doors, and is it specifically doors? Were there also windows? Is it portals? And
well, there's a shot from Iceland that's kind of a ruin of a house that no longer has a roof. The walls are degraded, but there's this doorway that remains, and so the image is looking through that doorway. But I'm standing, when I took the picture, in what was once the interior of the house. But I'm standing in grass because the roof is long gone. Everything's gone except these walls and this doorway. And I'm looking through this portal, and through that I see this magnificent landscape off into the far distance, more pastures, lakes, mountains, and so forth. So that what was going on there was that I was just sort of playing with the fact that here was this place which was once human habitation, but now it's just like a ruin. It's just like a little remnant of that, a ruin of that. And within that, you can see through this doorway into this other. You're standing outside, and you go through the doorway, and you go into another outdoor magnificent landscape. So it's a sort of, that's just an experience of standing in what was once inside but is now outside looking through it. It's sort of a puzzle, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on the concept of perspective with this show? Is the camera, I mean, if you're looking through doorways, if you're looking through portals, does the camera become or offer itself as the eye of the viewer? Is there a separation between the perspective of the viewer and the perspective of the camera? Point of view, that's the word that I'm really, that's the phrase that I should use.
So obviously the point of view that the viewer is given is my point of view when I press the shutter. Again, most the majority of the images do have people in them. And I think in every case, those people are absorbed in their own activity and not looking at me. There's a couple of exceptions to that. But for example, there's a bread maker that we see, a portrait that a couple of people said was sort of Caravaggio-esque with the light illuminating a little bit. There's another image of a girl reading, but she's sitting in the in this little niche in a big palace with a huge... So in all of the pictures with the that involve portraiture, as it were, it's more of a quiet moment where they're not looking at the camera and they're absorbed in their activity, and I'm trying to get close to them. So far away, so close. Here I am in a faraway land on the other side of the planet, but I'm trying to get close, if I can, in my observation to people in their daily activities, whatever that is, reading, bread making, sweeping, just a range of daily actions, daily life. I'm trying to really, as quietly as I can, as unobtrusively, without really putting too much of myself into the picture, select this slice of life and bring it back.
This is Eli Cook, and you're listening to Homegrown on 94.7.
18 minutes past the hour, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Homegrown, your show about local art, brought to you, of course, by the Blue Moon Diner. If you're just joining us, welcome. Welcome. I hope that you aren't caught by the clock shift. We're here with our man Will Kerner, who's talking about his photography exhibit that's up right now at the McGuffey Art Center, Far Away, So Close. India, Iceland, Haiti. Thoughts and about shooting in all three. What was one more difficult?
Each was fairly different. I mean, Iceland, as most of you know, is a very sparsely populated country. So my trip involved going around the entire perimeter of the island over the course of 2 weeks.
And what season was this? Are we seeing
it? Was in August. Okay. So the light in the midsummer, around June, it stays light all night. By August, it sort of gets kind of dark by about 11 to midnight and starts getting light around 4 in the morning. So I still slept normal hours, but it was anytime you were up, it was light, put it that way. But that trip and the work that I did there was a little bit uncharacteristic for me, in that I shot a lot of landscapes, a lot of structures in landscapes, almost no people involved in the pictures. I mean, in the capital in Reykjavik, there were pictures that I made involving individuals, involving human beings. But out in the rest of the country, it really became a journey and a photographic odyssey that involved photographing the landscape. And that's something that I haven't done as much as I have done pictures that involve people. So in contrast to this, in Haiti, virtually there are people virtually everywhere you go. So there, my more typical approach was to go, we were in the north of the country, I would go to Cap Haitien and go into the marketplace and photograph people, the activities in the marketplace, or go out into another part of the city. Just the textures on the surface, the walls, the painting, the colors, the light. There's so much to work with in Haiti that it can be almost overwhelming. It's just, right. And similarly, India. Now, India was a little bit of a hybrid of the two, in that at first
Where in India?
Well, in Ladakh, which is in the Himalayas. It's right on the border with Pakistan. Uh-huh. So very high altitude. The capital city, Leh, is at 10,000 feet, and you can end up at 12 or 13 very easily.
Yikes.
There, visited several different monasteries and photographed in those monasteries and around those monasteries, and also did some drone photography, which... video with drone, which I've not yet worked into a final piece. I still have all that material, and I'll be working that into a final piece. So there in India, and especially up in the Himalayas, I had both the landscape and people to work with combined.
Good for you playing with technology. What was it like working with a drone? Is this your first time working with drones?
It was my first time working with a drone, and it showed. In that, it came to an emergency landing once, And after I'd flown it a couple of times successfully, it took an emergency landing and was okay. And the footage is just spectacular because it's with a 4K camera and you just fly out and you're doing these shots that look, you know, like Hollywood cinematography, if I may say so, of these monasteries. And then I had another incident where the iPad, which serves as your operation device for the drone, overheated, which meant I lost control of it. It crashed. I thought, it's done. I went over and picked it up. It was perfectly intact.
Wow.
Lifted up. Got, you know, continued with my work. But the next day, there was a little bit too much wind, and it got caught in the wind, crashed, and that was it. But that was the last day that I'd been planning to use a drone. I would say that every flight that I made with a drone was an adventure. It was very electrifying. It's like, because I was new to it, and just controlling it was very, very challenging. But I got some good footage, and I'm looking forward to doing some more of that. The movie from the film festival that I saw last night, actually, The Eagle Huntress, was shot in Mongolia, and it had a lot of drone cinematography that was just absolutely fabulous. I highly recommend that to anybody who wants to see some drone photography in Northern Asia, which is a beautiful landscape, really a beautiful landscape.
I'm looking forward to that being a very specific but very watched subgenre of film, drone photography in Northern Asia.
So these trips that you took, were they just trips that you took your camera and the drone on, or did you specifically choose these places to go to take photography to be a show?
Well, I would say that basically I always have a kind of list of places or ideas in my head of places that I would like to travel to and do photography and make work. The drone just came up because it was new to me this year. Having a drone was new to me and experimenting with it. And I really didn't have a lot of time to practice with it before I left, but I knew that I wanted to try it. So I took it along. So
he's pushing me. So,
but so which comes first? You're saying the country or the project
the place or the idea?
It's
more,
it's like the place. The origin is the place. So, for example, Iceland is a place that I have long been interested in visiting. I'd gone there about 15 years ago just for 3 days and seen a little bit of it, and I thought it would be a fantastic trip to do the whole circumference of this island.
Yeah.
And as I'm a photographer, so I went there with the idea of photographing. It's a broad subject, if you will. I will photograph what I encounter along the way as we go around the perimeter. And it was mostly, as I said, what I anticipated, and it was mostly landscape.
Right.
There were some small villages, you know, I would see a few people, but basically I knew that I would be doing, you know, landscape type work when I was there. So
yeah, it's just I have a couple of friends who are also photographers, and they, just like you, they vacillate between photographing people and doing still life. And it's always interesting to me how they choose what kind of still life they're going to do. And one of them, a woman I've worked with in theater, and I know you've worked in doing theatrical photography too, Kara Walton, she just literally goes out driving. She's just like, I'm just going to take 4 hours and go driving and see what I see. And she's come up with some really interesting stuff. But I get the impression from other photographers that I know that's not the norm, that most photographers like, okay, I want to do this, and they go and do it.
Well, a lot, I think, for many photographers, work is project driven. They'll conceive a specific project. So they might think of, they might say, I want to photograph a small fishing village on the north coast of Iceland, and there's a particular family that has lived there for many, many generations. So I'm going to go to that town and photograph those individuals over the course of whatever, how much time they have, a month, 2 months, something like that.
Right.
So they would have that's an example of like a very specific project. You know, the approach that your friend has and that I have is more having a broader interest in the country and really trying to go and have the approach of, let me see what I can discover. Let me see what comes to me. The project-based approach to me is more like you have an idea and then you hone in on it and you work towards trying to really materialize pictures, make pictures that are really going to illustrate
And serve the project idea.
Right, serve the project this specific way. The approach that your friend and myself are talking about is more open to, you know, we'll go, and then in the course of going around the country, well, we might find a place that we're particularly interested in. So we may spend more time and energy in that specific place.
Right.
Once we've got, but we didn't know before we got there that that was necessarily going to be there. So it's a different way of working. To me, it's a way of working that's kind of like open to the world, see what the world gives you. It's not real. I don't think of it as being a passive way of just, you know, oh, we'll just see what comes along, but rather like really having your senses alert and being tuned in and having educated yourself about the place you're going and then sort of jumping in and seeing what comes to the top.
So one of the things we talk about a lot on the show with artists is how they do the marketing side and the business side of being an artist.
Right.
So like, how did you get to the point where you got shows hung in galleries? Like how did that happen? I mean, now you have a recognizable name. Everybody knows you. It's, you know, I'm guessing it's a little easier, but in the beginning, like, how did you do that?
Well, McGuffey Arts Center has been around for 40 years plus, as you know, and McGuffey is a place that, I've been associated with for over 25 years. So I'm an associate member there, which means I don't have a studio, but that I can hang shows there. And that's where I've basically had my shows for over the last 25 years. In terms of marketing, I mean, I'll be honest. I, you know, put forth my work. It's all priced. We have, you know, many people who come to the opening, and then some more people will see it in the course of the month. But I don't sell, like, a lot of prints from shows. It's just, I mean, fine art photography, and is with the ubiquity of photography now, everybody making images everywhere all the time.
Yeah.
There is much less, I think, kind of value ascribed to one specific image that's going to go up on the wall. So I've never really been able to depend on this for a lot of income. I mean, I've had shows that have sold as many as, say, 15 prints, which is, that's a lot to me. The average is probably a half to, you know, four or five half to, so that might like cover the cost of the show or something like that. I've had to pursue, I mean, most of my, in terms of earning a living from photography, to be quite honest, was a wedding photography career that for over 20 years was very lucrative. I mean, I'm lucrative enough to enable me to do some of this traveling and pursue my real interest. I sort of realized at the onset, you know, 25 years ago, that earning a living from making fine art photographs, there's a very, very small number of people are going to do that. So to be realistic, I need to do other things. So I've been very involved with Live Arts, which is also a pro bono, you know, nonprofit venture. I'm not paid for doing the work that I do at Live Arts.
Right.
But So what I did was the weddings and event photography and portraiture sort of paid my way. And then on my own, I could still pursue the travel photography, the live arts photography, and so forth.
It's such a benefit that, and because part of what I like to do with the show is look at the way different fields of art talk to each other. And to see where the similarities are and where the differences are, it's such a benefit in the field of photography that there can be a practical path, or at least a marketable path, for the photography skills. You know, because I'm thinking, but coming from the theater point of view, it's not like somebody needs actors for their weddings, right? It's not like a corporation says, you know what, I need a scene for our retreat. Can we just hire some actors to do that? Yeah. It's just like, that just doesn't come out. So,
right.
Which is, you know, why we have waiters in the world, fortunately.
Yes, right. Well, when I started wedding photography 25 years ago, there were many fewer wedding photographers in Charlottesville, so it was... you know, it was just sort of good timing. And as my business developed, it was basically word of mouth and, you know, past clients referring me and other vendors referring me. But frankly, in the last few years, wedding photography has become such a massive industry, and weddings themselves in Charlottesville, that I've kind of pulled back from it a little bit. It's just, I think something like that my heart was in it, but it wasn't the totality of who I was, shall we say, to be like, I wasn't born saying, I'm Will Kerner, wedding photographer. I'm like, I'm Will Kerner. I'm a photographer, and one aspect of what I can do to help support myself is photograph weddings, but I'm not going to spend all of my time and energy on that. And so in recent years, it's just become, you know, there's such a glut, if you will, of photographers that I've kind of pulled back and, you know, I'm actually doing a bit of architectural photography, photographing houses, and I'm planning to be doing some drone photography of houses as, you know, another sort of way of earning a living. You just have to keep thinking up new things and keep on moving forward.
Right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. Give the people what, where, and when, and how, and where to find
my show is called Far Away, So Close. Again, I'm Will Kerner, and it's at the McGuffey Arts Center through November 20th. They're open Tuesday through Sunday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. McGuffey Arts Center is on 2nd Street downtown, and it's in the Smith Gallery, which is on the main floor. If you walk right through the front door and right into the main gallery, you'll see the show, and I hope you will.
Far Away, So Close, McGuffey Arts Center, photos from India, Iceland, and Haiti. Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Clinton. Thank you, Leslie.
I'm going to do my list. Let's talk about 33 minutes past the hour, 94.7, some of the artistic things that we've got going on in our little town right now, currently running from now till November 29th. Shakespeare over in the mountain at the American Shakespeare Festival. It's 12th Night King Lear, Henry VI Part 2 by Shakespeare, and of course, still going, the modern musical Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. Currently running from now until November 13th, Gorilla Theater's teen production of Alice Through the Looking Glass at Gorilla Theater downtown on Allied Street. Today and tomorrow, auditions for Well at Live Arts. Get your auditions on and feel well. November 10th, MFA Reading Series at Millie Joe Coffee and Gelato continues, this time with Bobby Elliott and Robin Sarkin. On November 10th from to November 19th, Mr. Burns, a post-electric play by the UVA Drama Department in their Ruth Kaplan Theater. And also on November 10th, One Mic Stand, spoken word open mic at PVCC in the V. Earl Dickinson Building. From the 11th to the 13th, Hit the Road, Jack, by the Cremora Players out there in Cremora, Virginia, right over the mountain. The money this time, as you remember from the from our interview with the Cremora Players, they are a dinner community theater who donates some of their funds to a deserving person. This time, the money goes to a young woman who needs a kidney transplant. November 11th, meet the artist Tom Tagliano at Cunningham Creek Winery and Farm Store. Open mic night at James River Brewery. And let's look at just some of the musical options we have coming up. November 8th, the Judy Chops at the Sunday Cafe Music Hall. Blues Jam at the Front Porch Roots Music School. Hip Hop Open Mic Night at the Ante Room. November 9th, Quiet Fire at the Bebedero, and then the Blenders at the Bebedero. The Jazz Collective No. 9 at Fellini's No. 9. Scott Link at Dr. Ho's Humble Pie. On the 10th, it's the Michael Ellswick Gathering at Fellini's. And the UVA Klezmer Ensemble at Old Cabell Hall. Don't tell me that we don't give you a wide range of music to listen to. Klezmer to klez you out. Excellent. November 11th, open mic night at James River Brewery. Lisa Miller and the Juke Joint Junkies at Dirty Nelly's. Gil the Morn and Please Don't Tell and DJ Dre at Twisted Branch Tea Bazaar. And my new favorite band name, The Musical Suspects at Fellini's. November 12th, Serious Absurdity, Writing Successful Satire at the Charlottesville Writer House with Phil Jason. Check that out. There are all these great seminars going on at the Charlottesville Writer House. Really, make yourself available to them. November 12th, Willie D. at Almaral Cider Works. Gina Sobel at the Bebedero. The Jefferson Clerkship at Rapture. LG and Friends at the Whiskey Jar. And coming up on the 18th, Now Try This, Taking Opera Off the Road by the Victory Hall Opera Company at The Haven. Remember, every Monday it's the Singer-Songwriter Night at the local. Every Tuesday, the Traditional Irish Session at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub. Every Wednesday, the Open Mic Night at the Pro Renata Farm Brewery. Bob Bonetta at Cafe Katura. And the Mike Rosensky and Jeff Decker Quartet at Miller's. What? Every Thursday, it's the Woolen Writers Revival, hosted by Will Thomas Reed and Brian Craddock at Firefly. And if you can't stand that, go down to Miller's, get your fillers. It's the John Dearth Quintet, because every once in a while you just got to come down to Dearth. And that is just some of the wonderful artistic things going on in our wonderful artistic town. If you're an artist and would like us to talk about your event, let us know. www.facebook.com/homegrownwpvc. If you go to any of these events and want to talk about them, go to our Facebook page and talk about them there. www.facebook.com/homegrownwpvc. You can always send us an email at homegrown947@gmail.com. 37 minutes past the hour, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Homegrown, a show about local art, brought to you by Blue Moon Diner. Blue Moon Diner, breakfast every day, all day, with carefully constructed diner food in the afternoons and in the evenings. And speaking of the evenings, Blue Moon Diner is nice enough to support local and visiting artists this week. Tuesday, Mojo Pie. Wednesday, Jim Wave. Thursday, from Youngstown, Ohio, the Bees Trees with their collection and their fusion of jazz, roots rock, reggae, and the blues. Stay tuned afterwards for the Sunday morning wake-up call with your host, Rick Moore. He's going to be talking to Barbara Perry from the Miller Center Professor, the Miller Center Professor of Ethics and Institutions. We're going to head on to our next guest, but first, we're going to give a little bit of this. It was the kind of night when the city towered over you like a gang of third years at a sorority hazing. The futility sat in your gut like day-old pizza, and the emptiness clawed at you like your grandmother when you had that pillow over her face. In other words, it was a night like any other. Yeah, it was getting to me. The noise of all those little people out there, the ones who came to the city with big dreams, only to find out that the big boys and fat cats don't care about any dreams but their own. And if the little fish don't want to get swallowed, they'll have to buy their way off the hook. That's where I come in. I'm Dick Dravitt, P.I. Shut up! Me and my saxophonist went over to the bar. Nikki was working that night.
Hey, Dick.
A good kid with a nice smile who was learning the hard way that nice smiles in this burg won't get you a tall latte without a few bucks thrown in.
Yeah, at least I don't talk to myself.
She thought she was funny, but she was learning that a sense of humor won't get you an almond bikini wax at a fancy salon.
You want a drink?
Shut up! Whiskey and rocks.
In the same glass?
Only if it's half empty.
Of which?
Of both. And give me a soda water for my saxophonist. You'll drink soda water and you'll like it, see? And if you give me any more lip, that's the last lip I'll ever get.
You don't have to talk to him like that.
Nobody tells me how to talk to my saxophonist, see? That's when she walked in.
That was awesome.
Nothing like a little unrehearsed. Oh, well.
That was an excerpt from Big Fish, Little Fish, written by Joel Jones, one of the plays that he's got coming up for publication, e-publication, in his new collection, Answer Man and Other Bar Plays. Joel, welcome back to Homegrown.
Thank you, Clinton. Thanks, Leslie.
We love having return guests. It's awesome. And I didn't know you played the saxophone. How did I not know this?
I don't really play the saxophone. I played the saxophone in high school, and I still own a saxophone. So that's what I got.
Yes. See, I played clarinet in high school. I don't own a clarinet anymore.
Oh, no. What happened to it? Where is it now?
I hawked it.
Oh.
Because, you know, that's what happens when you're an artist and you need money to pay the phone bill.
Supposed to hawk the phone and keep the clarinet.
So tell us about this new collection.
Well, there's a group called Indie Theater Now. It's an organization in New York, and they do e-books. So you can, I thought for the Kindle, but it's actually just for the other devices. They do different playwrights and some other shows, like Tom Koash, who's also from Charlottesville, has a collection.
That's awesome.
And so he told me about it, and he passed my name on to them, and they approached me, and so we have a collection. And it's a collection of bar hoppers plays from the last you know, whatever, how many years have been Bar Hopper's Place, 25 or
we
something?
We don't need to do numbers. It's okay.
Yeah. So, and I've got some from all the different eras, and I put them together so they are, you can have eight plays. People can actually put them on as a set, as a whole evening.
Oh, cool.
With some substitute plays and for casting issues, like if you don't have a saxophone player, I've got a backup play for that. So we kind of organized it so people can do it with big cast, small cast, whatever, anywhere in the world that they want to.
That's very cool. Yeah. So like you said, you've been doing Bar Hoppers for a while.
Yes.
And that's coming up again, right?
I don't know. So they did it regularly yearly for 20 years or something like that for Offstage Theater. And then they kind of have come back occasionally since then when they found people. The person who did it last was Bree Luck, who now is the interim or artistic director of Live Arts. So right. I don't know if she has time to put on Bar Hoppers.
Looking for someone. Yeah. So
I don't know. I mean, so if someone is interested in producing Bar Hoppers, I'm sure that Offstage Theater, which still is
still around. Yes,
still around. Would love to have him, to talk to him. They also did him in New York for every month for a couple of years. A group called Third Man Productions. And then for a while, and those guys have gone on to other things. And then they also used to do them in Boston. And those people are.
There's one in Stanton.
So how?
I think there's one in Stanton.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. Yeah, there is one in Stanton. Yes, and I don't know who's doing that these days. Is that still Ampersand that did it before?
Maybe.
Yeah.
So how did you choose the plays that went into this collection? Like you said, you chose them so that it would be an entire evening. So what's the arc?
Okay, so the arc, the things I chose. There was originally the idea was this shows my limits as a marketeer that there was a group in that was going to do has produced my plays for Edinburgh, Scotland. There's a international French festival, and there's a group in Brighton and they have done shows of mine in Scotland, and this year they had a best of their 10 years of doing, and so a couple of my plays were in that, so that's a real honor. So it was really cool to have 10. And so I chose a couple, and they wanted to do three of these plays that they'd done before on tours afterwards, because they sometimes tour Australia, London, and stuff like that. So I wanted to be part of that. So I was trying to tie it in and get the e-collection out at the same time that would come. So
right.
People, because it was going to be a smash success.
Of course.
And then, of course, it was too, didn't happen. So, I mean, they still produced the shows. They did Answer Man, and they did something else.
Right.
But it didn't. But the indie thing didn't come out until a couple weeks ago.
Very cool. I think we have more, don't we?
Yeah, let's do another reading.
Let's do another one. Okay. What are we doing?
Power lunch.
There's okay. A lot of paper flying around right now.
How much time we have?
Hold on.
These are 4 minutes each, so you could do both easily.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Then we're gonna. Sorry, Clinton's shuffling paper. Hold on.
All right.
Stop making me the villain.
You ready?
Yes.
And here, Fred, is where we moved your office.
In a bar, Mr. Blunt Butter?
Not just a bar, Fred, a bar and a restaurant.
Where's my desk, sir?
Fred, desks are outmoded. Office concepts, relics, anachronisms. From now on, you'll sit at a table. Any table you like. No, over here.
Yes, Mr. Blunt Butter.
Now get to work. You've been dilly-dallying long enough.
What should I do, Mr. Blunt Butter?
It doesn't matter. We in management hired you to do those monotonous, unpleasant tasks, which we find distasteful. So find a monotonous and unplastic... pleasant task and do it.
Yes, sir. Do you think there's an outlet?
I just came in the front.
Also, I don't know the Wi-Fi password.
Not that this is a sort of bar or restaurant which I would normally frequent, since I must maintain a higher socioeconomic profile, except at lunch. We executives will often eat lunch at places we wouldn't touch for dinner. It gives us an excuse to undertip.
Why do I have to work in here, Mr. Blunt Butter? Why can't I keep my old cubicle with my headache-inducing computer screen, my buzzing overhead drop-ceiling fluorescent lights, and my creaky beige four-drawer metal filing cabinet? I miss my filing cabinet, sir.
Well, Fred, change is good for you.
I miss the coffee machine.
You can get coffee here.
I miss the coffee machine.
Fred.
The way it would break down every week. I felt a real bond with it.
Fred, we're making cutbacks, Fred. Cutbacks, streamlining, restructuring. And this time, we're not just sending the factories overseas or the tech support or the call centers. Yes, Fred, this time, we're completely eliminating all of our infrastructure. Think how much our stock prices will go up this quarter.
What about next quarter?
That's why you're a coward, Fred. You don't know how to live in the moment. Global capitalism is based on risk-taking, blood and guts, Rambo, John Wayne, butt-kicking all out, balls to the walls, ready-fire-aim initiative. Lead follower, get out of the way. will be the wave of the future. No factories, no offices. In fact, we're completely eliminating products.
Eliminating products?
Isn't it brilliant? Think of the money we'll save in raw materials, transportation, and best of all, no more product liability.
But we why have a company if we're not making anything?
We will be making something, Fred. We'll be making money.
That's awesome. And, of course, a very sad commentary on how business world works today.
An excerpt from Power Lunch.
Right. So how long is the longest play in this collection?
Probably 18 minutes, 17 or 18 minutes.
Wow. Okay. So, I mean, the two that we've done here so far have lent towards the funny. In 18 minutes, how serious can you get? Like, how much drama can be in 18 minutes?
I'm kind of a Aristotelian school that if you're dealing with people without consequences, then it's going to be comedy. That's either going to be funny comedy or unfunny comedy.
Right.
Like, so you can't really con people into thinking, you can't really do mumblecore plays or whatever that where it's just going to be people living their lives and it's going to be really interesting to watch the people on stage do the same thing.
Right.
And movies can do that because you've got the camera that can move around. It can do what Will was talking about with the still life. It can make you contemplate these ordinary things.
Right.
But on stage, it just doesn't, you know, anyway. So also through the years of Bar Hoppers, other people, we would have a huge number of submissions of dramas.
Right.
And not enough comedy. So I ended up being the niche comedy writer. So that's pretty much in short plays.
So you're the funny guy.
Yeah. And I do write monologues that are, you know, different, but the short plays, I never try to do anything other than, I mean, I try to make points, but not make points, but, you know, try to show human beings behaving in a real way with consequences. But, I don't try to make it, I feel like you can get away with a lot more if you have people laughing. You can really hit things. And if they're not
and
laughing,
make them think as they walk out the door.
Yeah. Or even if they don't think, I don't get away with saying what you want to say, kind of, which without getting killed is the most important thing. Yeah.
And, you know, I think there's something really palpable or really important to talk about in terms of comedy and theater in America and comedy and entertainment in America in general, because I remember reading a book of a theater professional whose name I won't drop because I don't want to be that guy. I was reading so-and-so's book. Yeah, screw that guy. But I was reading this professional, and she'd done a lot of work in Germany, and she was talking about the difference between working with Germans and working with Americans and how she hadn't realized her own milieu. She hadn't realized her own position as an American artist until she worked with non-Americans. And one of the things that she said most definitely was, Americans love to laugh.
Yeah.
And that there's such a push. There is such a push that we don't recognize because we're all surrounded in it. Yeah. But there's such a push in America for things to be funny. Yeah. And for, especially in our theater and our television and our movies, for there to be comedy.
Well, I mean, I guess I think that sometimes theater professionals probably feel it as a push. I think those of us who, I mean, I feel it as like how we express ourselves. I think we're funny people, and that's how we should express ourselves. And, you know, partly because
well said.
Yeah, and we're also, you know, verbal people, very verbal people. And, you know, in Europe, art developed a lot. You know, theater developed, you know, multi-language kind of where people are touring from language to language.
Oh,
and so
nice.
They're developing visual language and structure. And so even like European clowning, which is really fascinating to watch.
I was about to say, do you think that's why there's a stronger mime tradition?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely have to find a way to communicate with people when you only know 20 of their words. So, yeah, so it's kind of like, you know, silent moves or something. Whereas here, you know, everyone, especially people in the South or whatever, are very verbal and funny and inventive in the language we use. And yeah.
We're going to do the last one.
Let's say some. These are our short plays. We also, you know, I'm co-director of Big Blue Door, and let me just pitch that we're teaching a short workshop in what's called sketch writing, and the core of what makes these plays work is the comedy is this kind of sketch element that's in them, which is taking kind of two points of view and kind of cramming them together. And then so we're teaching a thing in this, and it's Tuesday, and you can go to bigbluedoor.org. It's at the end of the month on Tuesday nights. It's just a two-course thing. So two nights you can get yourself acquainted with how this stuff works and how the comedy works and how you come up with the ideas and how you can write them on a regular basis. So,
cool. All right, here is an excerpt from the title piece from the collection,
oh, wait
the
a second.
Local classic.
Oh, is that the two of you?
Yeah.
Awesome, cool.
Answer man. Man stands watching the door, sees a woman, runs, and he ducks behind the bar. The woman enters. She's clearly upset. She sits herself on a stool and sighs, and the man jumps up as the bartender. Hi, what can I get you?
I don't know. Budweiser, I guess?
Biggest selling beer in the world. Did you know that?
I guess I did.
Interesting philosophical point. Can a person really know something? If they aren't sure they know it, doesn't not being sure mean the person doesn't really know it? Or is there a state of knowing beyond recall? Or is this a semantic argument over an amphiboly in the word know? A real puzzler, huh?
Yeah, sure.
I know the answer to it. Would you like to know the answer to it?
Not really.
Oh. Well, do you have any other questions? Science? Math? Religion? Anything?
I would like my beer.
Sure. One Budweiser. Here you go.
Thanks.
Would you like to know the exact ingredients in a Budweiser?
No, not really.
Do you want to know how the glass bottles are manufactured?
Not really.
Do you want to know how they print beer labels?
My life sucks.
And you want to know whether that is an objective reality or merely a subjective experiencing of reality? Well, I can tell you.
David's a jerk. I can't believe I put up with him.
And you want to know the psychological explanation for the behaviors which you experience as jerkiness.
I can't believe you just dumped me like that.
You have relationship questions.
I always end up with undependable men.
And you want to know why.
No, not really.
Come on, ask me something. Isn't there anything you want to know about? The truth about saturated fat, the secret of the Lindbergh kidnapping, the origin of human suffering, the chemical composition of retsin.
I think I'll go sit at a table.
Please ask me something. Metaphysics, philosophy, history, anthropology, biochemistry, algebra. I know. How about sex? Everyone has questions about sex.
I should go.
Yeah, I can tell you how you compare sexually with other men and women. Wouldn't that be great?
If you touch me, I'll scream.
No, wait, that wasn't an overture. I'm only naming subjects for you to ask me about.
I think I'd like to check.
Ask me about fashion, sports, constitutional law. Ask me about anything. Come on, what have you got to lose?
I don't want to ask you anything. Now, how much do I owe?
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
That was the answer, man, by Joel Jones. Thank you so much, Joel. Tell us where and when and how we can get this collection.
Cool. So you can go to indietheaternow.com and backslash barhoppers and find it that way. You can just go to Indie Theater Now and look up my name. Or you can go to bigbluedoor.org. And then you can, we have a link to it from there that goes directly. So it'd probably be easier just to get it there. Also, people who, we haven't worked this out, but if you sign up for the sketch writing workshop, we're going to give everyone who signs up for that a free copy of it, which is $1.29 value.
That $1.29 value. Joel Jones, thank you so much for coming on the show again.
Oh, sure. It's great to be here.
Excellent. Are we going to do it? And now, it's time for Leslie's Weekly Rant.
Yes. Wow, it's been a couple of weeks. I might be a little rusty, right? So for those of you that know me, you know that I love birthdays. Not just my own, which I celebrate for at least a week. I love the thought of a birthday. It's amazing to me to think that on that day, every year, the world was missing something, and it was given what it needed. It was given a new person, a new soul, a new point of view. And for the people that happen to have been influenced by and have enjoyed that particular soul, it's important to stop and take a moment to appreciate them. And while I get that you should do that for the people you love every day, a birthday seems like a special time to do so. So today, I'd like to take a moment and appreciate a very special birthday. This woman has known me all my life. You could literally say that I wouldn't be who I am without her. She has been my mentor, my confidant, my friend. She also happens to be my mother. She gave birth to me 43 years and 1 month ago when she was 27. She took night classes and got her associate's degree from Piedmont Virginia Community College and then received a bachelor's degree in women's studies from George Mason University. She has been an officer in the National Council of Negro Women, Black Women United for Action, and numerous community college organizations. She is active in her Rotary Club and is currently the co-chair of the Democratic Committee of Newport News. She has worked at the University of Virginia, Northern Virginia Community College, and the College of William and Mary. She has also been active in her community. She has always looked for ways to make her life and the lives of the women and people around her better. And she did all of that while raising two children. While I admit there were nights I wished she had been at home rather than in class, there isn't anyone on the planet more proud of her accomplishments than I am. For those of you paying attention and following along, you should notice a trend at this point: education, self-improvement, social responsibility. This amazing woman, whom I call Mommy, don't judge me, has taught me so many lessons. I couldn't name them if I tried. She has always been there when I needed a shoulder or a kick in the ass, and she's done it all with style, flair, and most of all, with love. She is my best friend. She is my hero. She is the woman I want to be when I grow up. And today is her birthday. She turned 70. And for those of you who know her, you know she doesn't look a day over 50. For those of you that know her, take a moment and wish her well today, because I will be doing the same. Because I truly believe the world was made infinitely better when she came into it. I'm positive I'm not the only one. I love you, Mommy. Thank you.
Really?
What?
Really?
It's my mommy's birthday.
Really? We're going to take every incident of unprotected sex now and just bring it up to the level of celebrating it? I cannot believe
unprotected
what
sex
passes for a rant these days.
Oh my God!
I can't take it anymore. I had a break from this for 1 week, but now we're back to the ridiculousness of it. Oh my goodness gracious! I can't complain. I'm just gonna break it.
Okay, Clinton. All right. Wow. Okay, we had a break for a couple of weeks, and all I was doing was saying happy birthday to my mom. Like, I don't know what's wrong with him. He just flipped out. All right. Well, it's been wonderful. We want to thank our guests, Joel Jones and Will Kerner, for coming to share their art with us today. You guys have a great week, and we will see you next week.
You've been listening to Homegrown on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. You can contact the show on Facebook by searching Homegrown Charlottesville. Be sure to tune in again next Sunday at 10 for Homegrown, only on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.